So our second presentation of this session is by David Larrabee, speaking on creation care in the church, more than just the climate change. And this is actually part one of
two
parts. Yeah.
Good morning. Welcome back to the planet. As a freshman at Cornell, I joined the Eco-Justice Task Force, and my outlook on the environment and social justice was radically changed. As a senior intending to go to seminary, I found out that my denomination had no opportunities to explore eco-justice. Over the next 49 years, it has been rare to find a church committed to creation care. Yet, it is clearly a biblical concern. Over the last decade, most of my talks at ASA have been eco-justice and creation care. In 2024, the ASA created the Creation Care Affiliation, and I jumped at the opportunity to participate, along with George McGibbon, our next speaker. We would like to talk to you about involving the local church in creation care education and opportunities. The current administration is trying to bury climate change work, weaken environmental laws, and is rolling back environmental justice efforts. The church in the United States has not been effective at taking the issue of creation care to the administration. Perhaps the church's salt has lost its favorite flavor. That saddens my heart. How do we change this? During the last 50 years, a large number of resources have been created and are easily available. Unfortunately, misinformation is also widely available. Separating fact from fiction has become increasingly difficult for the non-specialist. The ASA contains individuals in a wide variety of scientific disciplines, as well as individuals with deep theological and biblical understanding of creation care, as well as its implications for a Christian lifestyle. We have the opportunity to contribute to the church, if not as individuals, then not as an organization, then as individuals. If not us, then who? One of the tasks of the Creation Care Affiliation is undertaking is a guide for local churches to help them address and understand the situations they face. The first step was the creation of a video, The Earth's Planetary Boundaries and Creation Care. Today, I would like to share two of the concepts in the video, the idea of planetary boundaries and our ecological footprint. Planetary boundaries enable us to think globally, while ecological footprint is one tool that facilitates local action. This follows the axiom, think globally, act locally. I will then close with some preliminary thoughts about its application to local church, and George will pick it up from there. Here's a link to the video. I encourage you to watch it. We are facing a number of important environmental issues, only one of which is climate change. How do we make this multifaceted situation comprehensible to the layperson? We have chosen the planetary boundaries approach developed by Rockström et al. In 2009. Planetary boundaries are like gauges and warning lights on your car's dashboard. They tell you if something is wrong. In 2023, Catherine Richardson et al. Published an update of the prior work and found that 6 of 9 planetary boundaries have been crossed. These planetary boundaries have a safe region, green, which ends at the planetary boundary, a region of increasing risk and concern, yellow to red, and beyond that is a danger zone, purple. The effects of exceeding a planetary boundary can vary in severity depending upon one's location. I would like to go into some detail on the nature of these boundaries. Planetary boundaries compare the present situation with that during the Holocene, prior to significant human perturbation during the Anthropocene. The Holocene started about 11,700 years ago, during which environmental conditions were unusually stable. It is during this period when human agricultural civilization started. During this time, humans thrived. Planetary boundaries take the environmental conditions during the Holocene as the benchmark. They address two key questions. First, how much can we disturb the Holocene values without running a risk of serious consequences? This is the safe operating area of the planet. Beyond this point, the risk increases as we move further and further away from a safe boundary. At some point, we enter a regime of extreme risk. The second question is, where are we today in relationship to those boundaries? A casual glance at the graphic shows that we have reached the extreme limits of some of the boundaries and are still within the safe zone of a few. Let's start with climate change. The variables that are used to determine the safe boundaries are, one, the CO2 concentration in the atmosphere, and we're up there, okay, and two, the anthropogenic component of radiative forcing at the top of the atmosphere. We'll get back to that. The safe threshold of CO2 is taken at 350 parts per million. We are currently around 420 parts per million. The upper limit is 450 parts per million, which we should reach in the next 10 to 15 years. Radiative forcing measures the imbalance between the incoming energy from the sun and the outgoing energy into space at the top of the atmosphere. Consider a pan of water on a stove. If more energy goes into the pan from the burner than leaves the pan, the temperature of the water rises up. If you turn the heat off, more energy leaves the pan than goes in, and the temperature falls. During the Holocene, the energy being absorbed from the sun was roughly equal to the energy being radiated into space, a radiative forcing of zero. Consequently, the Earth maintained a roughly constant temperature. This radiating force in turn includes a lot more than greenhouse gases. It includes the changes in albedo, the lightness or darkness of places of the Earth, which changes how much energy is reflected back into space. It is affected by small particles in the atmosphere that can reflect light back into space. It is affected by cloud and snow cover. The radiating force is measured in watts per square meter. Watts are a unit of power, and how much energy is absorbed in a given amount of time. A positive number means that the Earth is heating. Radiating forcing was roughly zero before the Industrial Revolution. A safe value is perhaps 1 watt per meter squared, and we are currently at 3 watts per meter squared within the high-risk zone. To move counterclockwise to biosphere integrity, also has two variables. Genetic diversity is measured by the number of extinctions per million species per year. Ongoing species extinction and creation is perfectly normal. There have been about 5 periods of massive extinctions in the past, most recent being the end of the Cretaceous period, about 65 million years ago, during which the dinosaurs went extinct. The safe boundary is estimated about 10 extinctions per million species year. It is currently estimated to be well over 100, which is the upper end of the zone of increasing risk. Consider an ecosystem as a wide variety of different organisms and a wide gene pool within each species. If conditions change so that one species is no longer viable, the wider genetic diversity, the more likely there's another species or a species that can take the niche of the now threatened species. The largest driver of biodiversity loss in our modern is our modern agricultural, both plant and animal systems. The functional health of the biosphere is based on the fraction of the biosphere's net primary production that humans are using. The net primary production of the biosphere is related to the energy flowing through the biosphere and is measured by looking at the amount of CO2 being transformed into biologically useful material by plants. It is estimated that we can safely use about 10%, leaving 90% for the rest of the biosphere. The estimate is that we are currently using about 30%. We are within the high-risk zone. We are depriving the rest of the biosphere the resources it needs to be healthy. Let's move to land system change, which measures the current forested area as a percentage of the potential forest during the Holocene. The lower the percentage, the more deforestation is present. The safe limit is estimated to be 75%. The end of the region of increasing risk is 54%, and we are currently at 60%. Other animals need this land to sustain healthy populations. Moving on to freshwater, has two components, blue water, surface and groundwater, and green water, water available to plants. Obviously, water is needed for a healthy biosphere. The boundaries are determined using pre-industrial data with the assumption that this is representative of the Holocene data. Currently, both measures have exceeded the planetary boundaries. Biogeochemical floats. This one's a little near to my heart because I live in the Chesapeake Bay region. The fertilization of agricultural fields and industrial use of nitrogen and phosphorus has significantly altered their natural flow through the world's ecosystems. Examples include dead zones in the Pacific and Atlantic Oceans, Gulf of Mexico, and my home Chesapeake Bay. The effects are most easily seen locally, but these boundaries are global. We currently exceed the safe boundaries for nitrogen and phosphorus. Nitrogen also exceeds the upper end of the zone of increasing risk. Moving on to ocean acidification. The oceans are currently a sink of carbon dioxide, absorbing about 30% of the CO2 humans produce. This leads to less carbonated items. I'll avoid the chemistry here. And consequently, also a more acidic ocean. Shellfish use carbonated items to form the calcite and creating and maintaining their shells. The reduction of carbonate ions is already having an effect on some shellfish and consequently up the food chain. Luckily, we are still within the safe operating area globally, even though we're seeing some of the effects in the Pacific Northwest. Moving on to atmospheric aerosols. Are the fine particulate matter present in the atmosphere? Aerosols are generated in fires, volcanoes, deserts, and in the use of fossil fuels. Aerosols have multiple effects on the biosphere, including changing weather patterns, reflecting sunlight in the upper atmosphere, cooling soot that warms the planet, and increases in asthma when it's low down near the ground. The effects of the aerosols on the reduction of sunlight can be measured, called the optical depth. Currently, it's valued about twice the estimated Holocene value, and we're still within the estimated safe area. The ozone hole, stratospheric ozone depletion, got a lot of press coverage a couple of years ago, and the success in dealing it has been held up as an example of how to deal with global environmental issues. There's some problems with that, but the last boundary, novel entities, represents the synthetic substances, radioactive substances, and genetic modified organisms that humans have created and placed in the ecosystem without adequate testing. Examples would be DDT and the CFCs that were released in the atmosphere and caused considerable damage. Now, interrelationships exist between the various planetary boundaries. They just stand alone. So let me give you one example. Land system change is strongly related to several of the other boundaries. Deforestation destroys habitats and so impacts genetic integrity. If it results in fewer plants, that reduces the ability to absorb CO2 from the atmosphere, impacting functional biosphere integrity as well as atmospheric CO2 concentration. Land use can result in albedo changes, impacted radiation forcing. The land is converted to modern-style agriculture. It can impact biogeochemical flows. So an interesting exercise is to take any two of these items and see whether you could find the pathway where one influences the other in reverse. There are three major limitations to planetary boundary approach. First, by concentrating on the ability to maintain a Holocene-like climate, it does not address the justice aspects of our actions. One interesting proposal is to juxtapose the planetary boundaries with some justice-oriented boundaries. Secondly, the understanding of the interactions is vital for formulating good policies. Finally, the planetary boundary approach does not address how our local lifestyles affect global boundaries. Perhaps the best example of exploring this question is the ecological footprint approach. The ecological footprint measures the area of land needed to produce what is consumed, food, paper, food, etc., plus the area necessary for sequestering of CO2. The approach dates back to about the 1990s. Thinking like an accountant, one side of the ledger is the area, the various types of land, fishing grounds, etc. On the other side of the ledger is the area of land needed for the production of what we consume, what we dispose of, as well as the CO2 sequestration that's not absorbed by the ocean. Now compare the land area needed with the available land area. This can be done locally as well as globally. The footprint network has made their footprint calculation capacity results available online. What follows, we'll use their results. taking the global footprint and dividing it by the available land area on Earth gives us a measure of how many Earths are required to meet our global demands. This is a plot of the world's ecological footprint versus year and the individual land demands. Today, we would need about, Today, up here at the end, we would need about 1.7 Earths to have our footprint of land to for our demands to match the available land. So we already need more Earth than we have. We cross a threshold of one in about 1970. The biggest footprint of land is that required to sequester our CO2 emissions. This curve here. Okay. But this is an average, and averages don't tell the whole story. So since we're in the U.S., let's look at the United States. So here's a footprint of time versus plot for the U.S. The U.S. has an ecological footprint of about 2.6 billion hectares, but only contains about 915 million hectares of land. If everybody in the world lived a U.S. lifestyle, it would take five Earths to support demand. Okay. Compare this to the 1.7 Earths currently required. Bring up the world to our standard of living would almost triple the requirements of the planet. The leading contribution worldwide would be the land necessary to sequester the CO2. I don't think I have the... Yes, 1.7. Yeah. Okay. Looking at how the U.S. ecological footprint breaks down by land, we have the following graph. Yeah. So if the world like the USA, 2020, you see the five. I'm sorry. And you can see here, the next one we have is the cropland. Okay. Here's the footprint. This is USA footprint per person. Yeah, oh, fine, thank you. Here, the vertical scales in hectares per person. 1 hectare is about 2.5 acres. Note that the total hectares per person peaked in about 1970 has been declining. In 2019, the U.S. had a footprint about 19 acres per person, roughly three times the global average. The biggest chunk is the land that would be necessary to absorb the CO2, in red, followed by cropland, forest products, and grazing land. For most industrial countries, the largest term is carbon. This makes this indicator most useful in discussing climate change. In general, the burdens of environmental degradation fall disproportionately on the marginalized. This is also true with the case of ecological footprint. On this map, the countries whose footprint is larger than their capacity are in red, and they're being environmentally subsidized by the countries with a surplus shown in green. This highlights whose lifestyle needs to change to mitigate environmental damage. Obviously, the U.S. is in red. If you're not from the U.S., you might want to take a look and see where your country lies on that. Let me close with a few comments about the role of the local congregation. Environmentally, the planet is changing, both globally and locally. While mitigation is important, adaptation will be vital. The local church will face a challenge on how to best serve the local community as it adapts. An example, here are two areas the local congregation can make a difference. Whiplash. Interesting, we are being exposed to transitions from one extreme to the other in a short period of time. When the weather transitions from drought to monsoon, we have a whiplash event. The temperature can go through rapid and wild oscillations. This kind of instability is becoming increasingly uncommon. It makes adaptation to the new conditions more difficult, since you have to be prepared for both extremes at the same time. The church, with its people, kitchens, and building, can perhaps provide relief to those who need it, but you got to prepare for it. Lifestyle changes. Part of being a Christian is a lifestyle that does not always conform to social norms. We are given the task of caring for the most vulnerable. Deep within the church's memory is the understanding that a small group of people can have a big impact over time. The church could be leading by example. The lifestyle and purchasing habits of a single person in isolation make little difference. As a community, we can live a prophetic lifestyle that supports the required transitions. If you would like to participate in this work or think your church would be interested, or even be interested in reviewing this work, please see George or myself. Thank you. Any questions?
Okay, we have 5 minutes for questions. And again, speak loudly so you can be picked up.
David, you have a slide in which estimated the number of Earths required to support the world. The world was living this lifestyle. In 2000 was six. In 2020 was five. What accounted for that reduction in mass?
So the U.S.'s lifestyle has been, we've been getting better. Okay. Part of that has been the transition from coal plants to natural gas plants. That's the good news. The bad news is that when you complete that transition, you no longer get the benefit of transitioning anymore.
Can you repeat that?
Our U.S. contribution to CO2 has been declining primarily because we've been ditching coal plants and replacing with natural gas-fired plants.
Bad news is
that transition is coming to an end. Coal plants are very expensive to run. Where they're being used is in places where you don't have natural gas. Off the coal is nearby. Once that transition is complete, then you no longer have coal plants to convert to give you the benefit. So I expect that curve, due to the energy change, to flatten out. Yeah. So
I have a practical implementation question. I agree with almost everything you said. I come from the state of Texas, which is heavily oil dependent.
Yep.
And what a lot of people don't realize, higher education is dependent on it. Each year in the University of Texas and Texas A&M get more than $200 million in oil money. The way the law is written, the more Texas produces, the more money goes to higher education. So that puts people in Texas in a real quandary that oil basically supports our educational system. And reducing oil production will hurt education. I don't have an answer to that.
Yeah, so I hear you. And if this is, I'll make the following comment. Economics determines who gets what. Okay. Therefore, all of economics is a moral science. Okay. So if we're having a moral quandaries about, oh, I have to keep using gas so I can fund higher education, that's not a physical constraint. That's not really just an economic constraint. That's a legislative moral issue. And I think you need to see it on that grounds. And you're going to have to solve it through legislation or things like that.
So another question? Yes. Go ahead, you.
Okay, all right. Thank you. This is really interesting. I'm curious about how this has been received in the local congregations that you've done work with so far. And also I'm curious about if you have any thoughts about why there tends to be so much skepticism towards climate science in many Christian communities.
Okay. I will take the first part. So we're not in the stage that we formally put all this introductory material together. George is going to take what I've said and says, how do we think we're going to apply it? We are looking for church. First, we're looking for people to help write this stuff, and then we're looking for churches in which to put it. Okay. So I'll answer you with that. No. The second question you had was, remind me.
Do you have any kind of
So the simple answer is that climate change has become part of identity politics. Mm-hmm. And so to not, that's a simple answer. Mm-hmm. I will give a practical example. I live in the eastern shore of the Chesapeake Bay. My representative in Congress is Harris, who's about the most, put it this way, if you could find a more right position to go to, he would go there. Okay. However, our local economy is heavily dependent on the Eastern Shore with the health of the Chesapeake Bay. So he's all for conservation efforts on the Chesapeake Bay. Just don't put windmills out in the Atlantic Ocean. Let's get rid of the EPA, but somehow magically keep the Chesapeake Bay healthy. So this is an example of the kind of strangeness you get when the identity politics meets economic reality.
And in the back.
David, thanks for the wonderful presentation. And thank you for lifting up the justice elements and implications and some of the things that gets lost with kind of at whatever scale we're looking at. We always miss them.
Right.
I was curious with specifically around the aerosols. Mm-hmm. And just as Robert reminded us last night of keeping that people-centered approach, it's wonderful to see that at the planetary scale in the green. But as you mentioned asthma, and as we look at that localized scale, in local areas and the impacts of air pollution and aerosols on human health, we can say that's definitely in the red. What would be a way of communicating that within this framework of getting at that local level of where we do have unsafe levels?
It's a great question. So before I moved to Chesapeake, I lived in Jersey City, and I'm a board member of Sustainable Jersey City. And we are a non-profit education oriented, trying to be the adults in the room on the conversation. Jersey City has the highest asthma rates of all of the county that we live in. The approach of the administration to dealing with this is, let's not measure it. What we don't measure, we don't know. So what we did is we went out as a nonprofit, got a grant, put atmospheric monitoring in place, hired a bunch of people from volunteers to come in from Rutgers, and we're publishing the results. And we're educating the people. There's a community in our town that is the most challenged, both economically and environmentally, with heat zones and whatnot. And we're doing an education process with them, using local people, dealing with environmental justice issues and whatnot. So it's a ground-oriented application, and like I said, we sort of had to hoodwink the administration, right? You're not going to measure it, we will. So, yeah.
Thank you very much. Thank you.